Welcome to Heard at Heritage. Heard at Heritage features cutting-edge analysis and thought from leading experts in and across the conservative movement, as well as premier events and programming from the Heritage Foundation here in the heart of Washington, D.C., brought straight to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our program, Empowering Every Child, unveiling the success sequence model for success in both school and life. Please welcome Jonathan Butcher, Senior Research Fellow in the Heritage Foundation Center for Education Policy.
Well, thank you, and good morning to everyone who's joining us in person as well as online today. We're so glad that you came to see us today and talk about this very important subject that overlaps education and family and a couple of other policy areas that we're going to get into here this afternoon. I'd like to begin by bringing up our panelists. So I'm going to introduce them individually, but I know they're all going to come up at once while I read their names and a little bit about them. So first, Lindsay Burke, who is the director of our Center for Education Policy and the Mark A. Colicatronis Fellow in Education here at the Heritage Foundation. She oversees Heritage's research and policy issues pertaining to preschool, K-12, higher education reform, and more. In 2021, she was tapped by Governor-elect Glenn Youngkin's transition team. She's been very active in what's happened in Virginia since that time. So we're very pleased to have Lindsay with us. Dr. Brad Wilcox is a professor of sociology and director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. You guys are welcome to come on up and take a seat while I read your bios. He is the author of the newly minted Get Married, Why Americans Should Defy the Ethics, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization. So Dr. Wilcox, glad to have you. And then from Florida, Dr. Grazie Christie is here with us today. Thank you for coming up from Miami today. She was appointed to the State Board of Education in Florida by Governor Ron DeSantis in March 2022. And she is a radiologist in the Miami area with 25 years of experience in radiology and diagnostics. So thank you to the panelists for being here today. So why are we here? What did we bring all of you here for? Before going into a series of questions from our panelists, I want to introduce the topic of the success sequence. Finish high school, get a job or enter college, and get married before having children. And not only that, things that have been established by research for decades, really, from those at Brookings, at our friends over at the American Enterprise Institute, as well as here at Heritage, we think schools should teach it. You should teach children these basic ideas. We created a model policy for school board members and educators to use as they try to integrate that instruction about the success sequence into their classrooms. Students should be taught the basic findings that following the success sequence leads to better life outcomes. The latest research shows that 97% of young people who follow these three steps are not poor as adults. 90% of young adults who complete the first two steps, so graduate high school, get a full-time job, are not poor in their 30s. By comparison, half of adults in their 30s who missed all three steps, half, 52%, are in poverty in their 30s. Before turning it over to questions, I want to address two things very quickly, because there are those who don't agree with the success sequence or don't agree with the way that the research has communicated the findings from what the success sequence represents. So first, why are we recommending that schools teach the success sequence when we, and I'll take the blame for some of this too, have written that schools are struggling to teach reading and math? Why would we ask them to do something else? And I would argue that it frankly is a responsibility for schools. 80% or more of parents want schools to teach character and virtue. According to surveys that we've done, Lindsay and I released a survey with some of our colleagues here just a few years ago and asked the question, do you, parents, want schools to teach about character and virtue? And the vast majority said yes. So what are those behaviors and those values that schools should teach? And I think what is in the success sequence, a very traditional understanding of marriage and the family, hard work, and meritocracy are all a part of the success sequence and what schools should be teaching along with math and reading. Americans want students to finish high school. There's widespread agreement that we want working individuals and productive citizens. We don't need a survey to tell us that. And that last, the research on the last item regarding marriage, it's very strong that children of intact married families have better outcomes than their peers. In fact, Brad will be talking to us again about his new book. So finally, teaching students about the success sequence, it's not meant to shame anyone for not following it. The purpose here is not to make anyone feel bad about choices they have made already. The intent is to empower young people with the information they need about making choices for the rest of their lives about being successful. And so we're going to talk about some of the new research and some of the questions on this very topic. So with that, let me turn it over to our panelists. I'm going to start with Brad. So Dr. Wilcox, so first, I know we'd love to hear more about your book. Before we get to that, one criticism of the success sequence is that, quote, work does all the work. But is this true, and can you tell us if your new book addresses that or how it's been addressed in the research?
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. So what we see in the research that I've done with Dr. Wendy Wang, my colleague at the Institute for Family Studies, is that even when you're kind of controlling for things like workforce status and education, what you do see in the research is that young adults who are following the sequence and specifically getting married before having kids are about 60% less likely to be poor compared to their peers who are having kids before or outside of marriage. And in terms of kind of the broader point, though, about marriage, is we see also, too, that single moms, for instance, with kids at home are less likely to be working full time. So this idea that kind of work does all the work neglects to sort of understand how difficult it is for many single parents to kind of navigate both full-time work and the care of young children. I was raised by a single mom. I know that there were plenty of times when she was raising us kids that, you know, there was a lot going on the home front, and it was hard for her to work full-time. So I can just kind of appreciate both from a professional and a personal perspective that full-time work is often challenging for single parents, and that's one reason why we think that it's better for parents to get married and be together before they go ahead and have children, both obviously practically but also financially as well.
And part of that is a point that I know Melissa Kearney has made in her recent book, right, The Two-Parent Privilege, about how the importance of having two parents is simply they have more time because there's two of them, right? I'd love for you to say just a word about your book before we go into the other panelists. I believe that we have a slide, though, showing the model resolution that we have at the Heritage Foundation that we have put together. So this model resolution, it's available online. There should be a link that will take you straight to it. It's meant for educators and school board members to use to help to integrate the ideas in the success sequence into classroom instruction. It's got a whole list of the findings from the research on marriage, on work, on families, on the success sequence itself. It's got footnotes to the research, so you can see how the evidence plays into that. So that is available there and is meant for those at the local level in particular with schools to use as they put the success sequence into the classroom. But Brad, tell us about your book a little bit before we go on.
So let me kind of just make two broad sets of points about kind of the research on marriage and kids, but also adults. And I think Melissa Kearney's new book, The Two-Parent Privilege, kind of just gives us a great portrait of the way in which empirically our kids are more likely to be flourishing when they're raised by their own married parents. I would just add that my book also touches on that. And I think the most striking thing about my book in terms of the kid findings is that what I'm seeing in the data is that boys today in America are more likely to end up in prison or in jail than to graduate from college if they're being raised outside of an intact married family. And by contrast, boys who are being raised in an intact family are about four times more likely to graduate from college than they are to spend any time in prison or in jail. So it's just kind of a pretty powerful, I think, empirical illustration of the way in which what happens in our families matters for the welfare of our kids, both in the educational domain, but also kind of more broadly in the country as a whole. But my book is actually geared more towards thinking about the impact of marriage on adults. And unfortunately, Jonathan, what we're seeing oftentimes in the media today is kind of this idea that marriage is a pathway to, in a sense, poverty and, you know, misery, in a sense. I mean, there are stories in Bloomberg that say kind of getting married for women is a bad path financially, just kind of, you know, totally false, but in Bloomberg, you know. There are stories in the New York Times talking about how married motherhood is basically, you know, a recipe for, you know, again, being miserable. So we have to kind of acknowledge and recognize that we're often getting some pretty bad messages about marriage for both men and women. From the left, it's really about women. From the actually the new online right, Andrew Tate, I think probably many of you know about him. He's saying that marriage is a bad deal for men. So from kind of the extreme right and the sort of left, we're getting a bad message about marriage. And what my book shows us is that for ordinary men and women, marriage is a path both to prosperity typically, or at least financial security typically for adults, and then also for towards happiness as well. And so when it comes to that classic Jeffersonian pursuit of happiness, there are no groups of both men and women who are happier in America today than married dads and married moms. And so kind of contra Andrew Tate and contra some of these stories in the New York Times, what we do see is that for most of us, becoming married and having kids is linked to more financial security and to more happiness. And I think one of part of the value of the success sequence is just kind of communicating to younger adults that contra some of these, you know, new narratives out there, these false narratives out there, that marriage actually is both a kind of path to prosperity oftentimes, and then also towards kind of flourishing more generally.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Wilcox. So, Lindsay, I'm going to turn to you. So, we were talking just earlier today. There was an event that we did here at Heritage several years ago on the success sequence, talking with a school leader about how he has looked at the success sequence for his school and for the parents in his community. Can you tell us about that? What is it? What did you learn from that conversation? How does that play into what we're talking about today?
Well, I actually think you were at the event as well. It was me, you, and Derek Max, who used to run Cornerstone School in Southeast DC, and it was all the way back, I think, in 2016 or 2017. So we've been thinking about this for quite a while. But before I get to that, I'm glad that Brad brought up messages and messaging, because when I got up this morning thinking about framing this event, I thought about milk and the milk campaign and what that might mean for marriage. And so if you go back to the 1960s, milk was really a staple of the American dinner table and breakfast table and lunch table. And schools, doctors, teachers, they all promoted it. But the ascent of soda in the 1970s began to erode milk's market share. As one marketing professor put it, quote, "Milk was white and came in gallons." Super boring. So soda came in colorful cans and was exciting and was fun to drink. And so you probably all remember those pithy slogans from the 90s from soda companies, right? Mountain Dew had "Do the Do." Gatorade had "Be Like Mike," referring to Michael Jordan. Sprite had "Obey Your Thirst." I mean, maybe I'm aging myself, but seems like yesterday, right? Obey your thirst, drink Sprite. So at the time in the 90s, then Big Milk, if you will, realized that they needed their own Obey Your Thirst marketing campaign. And so in 1993, the California Milk Processor Board, super exciting organization, hired a marketing firm that eventually came up with the Got Milk slogan that we all remember. That slogan was everywhere. It was in magazines, it was on billboards, it was on TV. All of the celebrities, you'll remember, who had milk mustaches in those campaigns. It was a huge success. And a year later, in 1994, milk saw for the first time an increase in sales prior to the previous decade. So teaching the success sequence, I think, can do for marriage what Got Milk did for the California Milk Processor Board. And I think, Brad, I haven't read your new book yet. I'm sorry.
Get married campaign.
Right, so I think we need a Got Marriage campaign, right? A Get Married campaign. Yeah. But not to be taken up by government per se, but to be taken up by schools across the country. And I say government per se because I do think this should include public schools as well as private schools. In a write-up of the 10 most successful marketing campaigns of all time, an author explains that the focus group participants in that initial research for the Got Milk campaign discussed, quote, how not consuming milk felt significant. They were told, don't drink milk for a week before you come to this focus group. How would they eat their cereal, they wondered. What would they dip a cookie in? How was life without milk, or why was life without milk so bland? So imagine that concept of not milk that revolved around this distress. You could imagine a similar discussion in private schools about the absence of marriage and what that might mean for your life down the road. And so for private schools, that makes sense, right? Most private schools have a values-oriented mission. They are mission-based organizations. Public schools have a different charge, I would argue, when it comes to promoting the success sequence, to be more descriptive than prescriptive in their discussions, but they do have a role to play. And Brad has detailed over the course of his career why it's so urgent, but your recent piece in The Atlantic, I think it was a Valentine's Day piece, put it best, and so I'll just quote Brad, even though he's sitting here. Quote, young adults are dating less, the marriage rate has dropped by more than 60% since 1970, and the fertility rate at 1.7 children per woman is well below the replacement rate of 2.1. About 1 in 3 Gen Zers are projected never to marry, and about 1 in 4 Gen Zers will never have children. In other words, a record share of today's young adults will likely end up not only without a spouse, but without any immediate kin, end quote. So just to put a little more meat on that, if you look at the data, so in 1960, the median age for first marriage was 20.3 years old for a woman and 22.8 years old for men. By 2022, the median age for first marriage had risen to 28.6 years old for women and 30.5 years old for men. Much of that increase has come over the past decade, that increase in the age of first marriage, with the median age of first marriage going up by more than 2 years for women just over the past decade, from 26 to 28, and by nearly 2 years for men to 28 to 30, just over the past decade. So we can discuss, I think, in greater detail what that might mean for policy, but in a long roundabout way to answer your question, from the event that we did in 2017 and thinking about the implications to today, it's only gotten worse in that short amount of time. Last point I'll make, when we did that event with Derek Max, who was the principal of Cornerstone, he had pointed out that, yes, schools should teach the success sequence, but they should also model the habits of dialogue within a successful marriage. And I thought that that was a really important point. And so Derek had said at the time at Cornerstone, quote, we develop the virtuous student. It prepares you for marriage and life in a lot of ways. At our school, we do not yell at students. One of our philosophies with teachers is that in a well-managed classroom, the students should be treated with dignity and respect, and the teachers should be treated with dignity and respect. That is such an important thing for marriage, he said. Our students are taught how to have disagreements and conflicts in a sensible way. And so I think that's a really powerful aspect of the success sequence that is not frequently discussed.
Yeah, thank you, Lindsay. I think those are terrific remarks. The Got Milk campaign, I think, is a great example to use. Dr. Christie, before moving to you, I want to mention one thing that I think we were just able to answer just between Dr. Wilcox and Dr. Burke was some may say, well, schools should be neutral, right? They should be neutral on values. They shouldn't, you know, all this stuff about whether you should get married or not, it's not something schools should do because they should be neutral on things like this. And I would argue immediately, Lindsay, I mean, I think you would agree, schools are already teaching values, right? I mean, they have Black Lives Matter Week of Action, as our colleague here at Heritage has Jay Green has demonstrated. Most of the large school districts in the US have DEI coordinators. They have people on staff to push the application of critical race theory through DEI, right? Which is in itself is a value-laden, right, philosophy. So they already, I mean, you know, the 1619 project some years ago was announcing how many thousands of schools were teaching, you know, their curriculum, which in itself has been, you know, pointed out as is
your family.
Precisely, right? So. Yeah. The Black Lives Matter Week of Action, one of their 13 values is they're critical of the nuclear family. So all of that to say, I think, is that we can answer that right away. If someone was to come back and to a state policymaker, to a local policymaker who said, hey, look, you can't do this because schools must be neutral, I think it's easy to come back and say, no, schools are already, they already have values that they're pushing. And we're arguing here that we have evidence that this is a set of decisions and behaviors that will lead to a child's success in the future.
Schools are not values neutral organizations, so it's a matter of which values they will be teaching. And I think just to put a to point on it, conservatives and those interested, and Success Sequence in particular, are finally really engaging in what those values might look like and recognizing that these are taxpayer-funded, government-run institutions, and we should have a voice at the table.
Thank you. So, Dr. Christie, we were talking just a few weeks ago about this panel and what this event was going to look like, and you shared something of that I said to you. I said, hey, look, everything that you just said just proves the Success Sequence. You shared a personal story, if you'd be willing to share that.
Yeah, and before that, to the point that you were just making, in Florida, where I'm on the Board of Education, we do definitely believe that we're teaching values in school. And for instance, this last year, we implemented the teaching of the victims of communism. So we have 2 hours. 2 hours doesn't seem like a lot, but 2 hours is something. Over the course of the high school years, all the children in Florida are going to learn that, communism has produced hundreds of millions of victims, and it's a pernicious ideology. And how wonderful, right, that children are learning that in Florida. So definitely values are things that we embrace and we teach. And you're either teaching the right ones or the wrong ones. And definitely the Success Sequence is, it's one of those things. I was just speaking to your resident philosopher here at lunch. We were talking about the fact that our society, our culture right now is having this moment where we're having to re-explain the things that we've all known all the time, things that are so naturally part of how we understand the world and how we interact with the world on a reality basis, right? Now we seem to have to re-explain it, understand it more deeply, and then be able to teach it, whether it's that people come in male and female, or that the Success Sequence, which is basically the sequence of responsibility and industriousness and a culture of education and work, right? That these are very basic concepts that everybody understood right up until yesterday. So how wonderful that the Success Sequence is something that, like other things, we take the time to stop and understand it better, do the statistical analysis so that we come up with the numbers. And on that point, I went through in detail all the different statistics that you collected on this, on the Success Sequence, and I was very, very interested in the Hispanic part. I'm Hispanic, and I came to the United States at the age of 11. And my family were recently, I was born right after my parents were exiled from Cuba. And we were very poor for many years. I think we left poverty when I was about 16 or 17. But my parents employed the Success Sequence in their lives. And it was that simple triad, right? Industriousness, responsibility, and studiousness, right? In our country, in the United States, we happen to have still a country in which these things are rewarded with success. And it's not necessarily the success of the basketball courts or the Hollywood, right? No one says you're gonna fly away in your private jet, but you're gonna have the kind of life where you'll be proud to live that life, right? That you are putting food on the table and your children are growing up strong and healthy, and you're able to educate them in turn. And that's what I saw in my family. And even though I think I went to 9 schools or maybe 10 schools between kindergarten and 12th grade, even though we had complete instability around us, we were moving all the time and my parents were trying to find their way, studying and also working, we had the family and we had that focus on the things that matter, which if you break them down right down to the basics, it is the Success Sequence, right? My parents married before they started having children, clearly, and then pursued education and stayed together and put the order of things in order. My mother never graduated from college. My father did, and all four of me and my 3 siblings, of course, graduated from college and masters or doctorates, and that's how we expect to go on. I was really impressed by the statistics and how, if you even if you are in if you happen to be born into a higher societal level, right, or income level, and you have all the pieces are there, if your parents don't do the success sequence, you will fall off. You will fall off into poverty, or very likely will fall off into poverty. And or if you don't employ the success sequence, you will fall into poverty. Mm. And that's the statistics don't lie, I don't think. Mm. And I've seen it work.
Very powerful. Thank you so much. And so, Dr. Wilcox, so back to you. As we were talking in the hall a moment ago, you talked about how the success sequence has positive benefits for students from different socioeconomic and ethnic backgrounds. Can you say a word about the stats that you were sharing earlier?
Sure. So we see in research done with Dr. Wendy Wang, my colleague at the Institute for Family Studies, is that young adults who are African American, who are Hispanic, who are Anglo, are reaching kind of above poverty as they move into the late 20s and 30s at levels of about 95% or higher. So in other words, the vast majority of young adults, be they white, black, or Hispanic, are kind of avoiding poverty in the late 20s and 30s if they've kind of gotten that high school degree at least, if they've worked full time in their 20s and gotten married before having kids. So this is not kind of like a path that's just limited to a certain demographic or segment in American life. This is a pathway that's sort of accessible and open to Americans with a wide range of backgrounds, is the point that I would make.
So. Yeah, excellent. So adding on to pivoting just a little bit here, because as we talk about this model resolution, in our conversation from last fall on this issue, there was some things going on in Utah, and you had written something for an outlet in Utah about what was going on there. Can you talk about that?
So Utah has already passed legislation basically endorsing the success sequence, and I think now it's sort of going over to the sort of Board of Education there to kind of look into how that would be implemented. So they've kind of already begun this process of trying to get the success sequence into schools across the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. And the hope here is that other states like Florida and, you know, Tennessee and Texas and Arkansas will kind of follow in the footsteps of Utah. Utah has also kind of pioneered some work this past year, that is in 2023, on sort of teens and tech on social media, which has also inspired legislation in places like Florida and Texas and Arkansas and Louisiana as well. So we're kind of hoping that both on the teens and tech front last year and now on the success sequence front this year, other states are going to be kind of taking some steps, both to kind of protect our kids from big tech and then also to kind of equip them to, you know, make better choices when it comes to schooling, when it comes to work, and when it comes to marriage as well.
See, and I think that this topic would fit so nicely with what's happening with parent bills of rights that are passing around the U.S. as well. I think we're somewhere between 15 and 18 states have a parent bill of rights already in law. They frequently get updated. Florida, in fact, passed a parent bill of rights and then updated it a year later and added to it. But there are states that have, you know, very basic provisions that say a parent is a child's primary caregiver and the state may not interfere with that unless there's a compelling, you know, governmental interest, something known as strict scrutiny. And increasingly, states are adding to those bills of rights with additional provisions saying, you know, if a child comes to school and is confused about their sex, the school must notify the family. Or if company wants to do a survey of children, ask them very personal questions, parents must be notified. So parent bills of rights, I think, are these two things about what's moving with the success sequence as well as parent bills of rights, I think are all kind of going in the same direction here of promoting the parents' ability to be active in their child's school. Lindsay, so we're going to pivot a little bit again here. So you've been doing some research recently about college and family formation these days. Can you give us a kind of a sneak peek about what's to come here and what you'll be writing about?
Yes, and caveat that this does not mean people should not go to college, right? It's a good deal for some people. It's not a good deal for other people. The question, I think, is it depends on if you complete and what you want to do and if you find a job that's related to your degree. But it is notable that we've seen a non-trivial increase in the number of people going to graduate school in particular over the past decade and a half or so. So if you look at, and remember I mentioned earlier that just in the past decade, we've seen the age of first marriage increase 2 years each for men and women, from 28 to 30 for men and from 26 to 28 for women. At the same time, enrollment in graduate programs increased 5% between 2010 and 2019 and another 5% by 2021. So a non-trivial increase in graduate program enrollment. So how does that all tie in? Well, again, this is descriptive and not prescriptive, but if you're spending an additional, you know, after you graduate undergrad, 2 years to obtain a master's, 4 years probably at minimum, to do a PhD, so we're talking about potentially another 6 to maybe even 10 years, right, total, in graduate school, people are spending a lot more time on education, and many of them put off marriage during that time period. So I do think that there is a relationship potentially between this delayed marriage age and its continual rise. So, and again, you know, this is not to say you shouldn't pursue a, you know, graduate degree or a PhD, but, you know, I'll say it from personal experience, it was a whole lot easier to be married and do it and to have support than to not be. So it's something that we're starting to think about. What is the relationship between, say, for instance, massive increases in federal student aid, the increase in the amount of people going to graduate school and spending additional years in college? It takes longer today on average for somebody to complete their undergrad, right? The average graduation rate is 60% for a four-year degree, 6 years for a four-year degree. It's taking students on average 60% of them to complete in that amount of time. So people are spending more time in higher ed and potentially delaying marriage as a result of that. So it's something to think about. The Grad Plus program aligns neatly with those numbers that I just threw out. So it began in 2006, the Grad Plus program, and of course this allows you to borrow up to the cost of attendance to attend graduate school. So this is where you end up with those really high balance numbers. When you hear the $200,000, $220,000 figures that are thrown out, those are often reflective of the people who are going to medical school, going to become an attorney, but which is all valuable and worthwhile, and those individuals largely can repay that loan. But we also get the PhD student who decided to go and pursue a PhD, rightly or wrongly, in something like sociology and spend a lot of time doing it. So if you add on to that, the Biden administration's continual effort to forgive, to quote forgive or cancel, right, make you pay for somebody else's debt, we have a lot of incentives built in now to encourage people, more people, to attend graduate school in particular and spend a longer time doing it. And I think we should think about what that means for age of first marriage, family formation, et cetera.
Yeah, I think there's a Babylon Bee article where the barista is handing a cup of coffee to the plumber and saying, thank you for paying for my sociology degree, right?
Exactly.
So this is all very relevant, right? Yeah. So Lindsay just teased the new research that she has that'll be coming out shortly. Dr. Wilcox has his new book, Get Married, and Dr. Christie was just saying earlier she has an op-ed in the Federalist today. So if you're looking for more on the work that each of these have done, my panelists here, you'll be able to find that as well. Dr. Christie, another question for you. Tell us what's happening in Florida in terms of the curriculum for students. You touched a little bit on how your board had just passed something new. You were just talking about it a few minutes ago on the victims of
yes,
communism, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's on the board's agenda? What else is the board doing? And would something like this fit with what you think you don't have to speak for yours, but what a board would be looking for?
No, I'm pretty sure the Florida legislature would be very interested in this and something like this, because it does fit in with our vision in Florida, our current vision under Governor DeSantis, who's been really, I think, spectacular on education. And I know that Florida's getting great grades everywhere on education, and it's definitely, it's well earned, because we're concentrating on parental, as you mentioned, the parental rights, which have been eroded across so many states, but not in Florida. And yes, the success sequence, I think, is something that could be easily incorporated. And it goes with the idea that we understand that we are teaching values. To your point of what other kinds of education or graduate education, we're spending a lot of time and effort and money on expanding non-college educational opportunities, vocational training, apprenticeships, other ways of achieving financial stability and staying in the middle class, which is possible in a state in Florida, a state like Florida where you don't, without going to college and making all that debt that may or may not get forgiven or passed on to someone else. And Yeah, I think the success sequence is, it goes hand in hand with everything we're doing in Florida. We're not afraid. I think in Florida, we're not afraid to go for the things that we know will help our students. And away from the things that are ideologically motivated by political actors and things that, in the end, damage children's chances for success. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to write a list because we're all thinking of that in our heads, right? What are the things that are damaging children right now? But
can I piggyback off that?
Yes, of course.
A second.
Please.
So if you look at the data on college graduates, because often the question is, do college graduates on average earn more than their non-college peers? And on average, yes, if they enter a field that actually required a college degree. So if you graduate college with a bachelor's degree and enter a job that requires a college degree, you earn on average $28,000 more annually than someone who only completed high school. But that number drops to $8,000 if you have a college degree and enter a job that does not require a college degree. So on average, yes, you're still out earning the high school diploma only holder, but only by about $8,000. And so I think this point on apprenticeships is really important. I was actually looking up this morning for a different project, the median salary for different fields. And elevator technicians, $69,000 a year, plumber, $60,000, electrician, $60,200. And so that's just your median salary for your typical apprentice, field or worker. But consider the electrician or the mechanic who then goes off to start their own company. I mean, your earnings potential is much, much greater as a result of that. So I do think a big part of this is restoring the value of those professions that don't require your typical four-year degree, where you're going to hear nonstop about, the problems of the nuclear family and why it should be dismantled.
Yeah, no, very good point. And if we have time here at the end, we have a few minutes before we're going to move to questions. If we have time here in the end, I have a question, Lindsay, for you on that very topic. But I don't want to run out of time before mentioning the other new research on the success sequence, which I saved here for the end. Angela Ricciuti cannot be with us, but she promised she was watching online, so I hope you're there. But she wrote a new paper on the success sequence. All of the research that had been done, or most of it up to this point on the success sequence, was talking about those who hadn't gotten to that point yet, right? So how, you need to for young people to do this as they, enter those prime working years. But what happens after? What happens if you're in your 20s or into your 30s? Can the success sequence still help? And Angela asked that question, and in her research, she found that as unmarried mothers progressed towards the success sequence milestones, their chances of being in poverty declined. For example, only 9% of mothers who had achieved all success sequence milestones by the time their child turned 15 were in poverty. So that means 91% weren't. For comparison, or at least 91% weren't at that level. For comparison, the poverty rate for unmarried mothers who achieved none of these milestones was 78%. So the point that she is making, and she used data, and so the social scientists who have looked in these issues around family will be familiar with this data set. It used to be called the Fragile Families and Childhood Wellbeing Study. It's been renamed to something else now. But she used that data set, which looks at non-intact families, and asked the very question whether achieving the success sequence later in life could still help. And it turns out it does. At every year of the survey, the more success sequence milestones reached, the smaller the percentage that experienced poverty. Marriage later in life proved to be an important factor for reducing poverty. Nonetheless, even among those mothers who remained unmarried, having at least a high school education and working full time, so two of them, right? High school education, working full time, correlated to much lower poverty rates than having none or only one of these. So pursuing the success sequence even later in life can have positive effects. So before we turn it over to questions, Lindsay, let's tease out for just a few minutes that we have here, college or work, right? College or the workforce.
Yeah.
And before I tee this up for you a little bit, I think we're both of the same mind on what our answer would be, but to not spoil it for the audience, I won't spoil it. But I will say this. So I was touring a charter school just last week. It's a charter school of kids whose parents probably didn't go to college. They're living at or around the poverty line.
And the whole goal of that school is to get the kids off to college, right? They call them scholars when they walk in the door, and they say college is where you're headed. But is this what every school should do?
So it's a great question. And I think aspirationally, maybe. But at the same time, we have to have this dual track. And I do think there's been almost a renaissance in career and technical education and vocational education lately. There are high schools all across the country. California is a really good, surprising example where they are really putting an emphasis on career and technical education and vocational education. So I think that is a very good development that has happened over the past few years. One thing that we often forget, I think, you know, if you're sitting here at a heritage policy conversation in DC, you probably have a degree, but we often forget that that is not the majority of Americans, right? Mm. It is still the case that only about 38% of all Americans hold a bachelor's degree today, which again, not to beat a dead horse, but it is why the Biden administration's student loan cancellation is so regressive and problematic. Because it is asking the vast majority of Americans to take on debt they didn't assume, and presumably is asking a lot of truck drivers and waitresses and electricians and mechanics to pay off that gender studies degree. So it is incredibly unfair. So I think it does have to be, it of course is student and school dependent, but we have to reprioritize and really embrace the idea that there are multiple paths to climbing the ladder of upward economic mobility in America, and that vocational education is one that we should really embrace. And so I'm happy to see schools moving in that direction.
Yeah, Brad. Yeah.
Add to Lindsay's comments, I think one critique of the success sequence that we get from some people is that are we basically proposing a model like we would see in East Asia today, where young adults are spending, just to your point, are spending years and years and years in some kind of higher education. By the time they finally work their way around to getting married and having kids, often very difficult to have, you know, even one child, not to mention two or three kids. And so I think, as I think probably all of us maybe envision the sequence that are playing out in ordinary schools, we're not saying that, you know, every kid in America has to maximize their years in school. We're just saying that getting at least a high school degree is a great idea. And then probably either getting some kind of, you know, vocational training or apprenticeship training that kind of positions you for a, you know, basically a decent skilled, you know, career, or pursuing college in that track, you know, alternatively would be good. But we don't have to think about education as that first step in terms of, you know, getting a graduate degree or spending many, many years, you know, as an adult under some kind of higher education, you know, regime.
Well, and I think we made it 42 minutes in a Heritage panel without talking about school choice, but I think the example that I just gave to you of the school I visited last week, they were a charter school. They were a school of choice, right? If you didn't feel like that's where you wanted your child to go, you could go somewhere else. And so shout out to my friends at the South Carolina Public Charter School District. We also have charter schools that are for adults who have dropped out and now want to go back and finish a high school degree. I mean, that's the point, right? The point is for that option to be there, because real conversation has to be had. In particular, I would argue among those in the middle class with their kids that going to college and taking on a big loan is a big step, right? I mean, that's a big a burden that you're going to take into your working life, and you should think very hard about, you know, whether that's something that you want to do. And especially these days, with all of the criticism that, appropriately so, Ivy League institutions in particular have been facing because of what's happened lately with their administration, it's whether or not that's worth it, right? Is that worth taking on that debt when you have this kind of evidence that you could go into the workforce and prepare yourself perhaps later to then earn something that would make you more successful?
Well, and it's unfortunate that people think this way, but there's a lot of survey data out now that suggests young people delay marriage because they'll say they've got student loans, and so they can't get married until they pay off their student loans. I think it's probably easier with two incomes, right, to pay off your student loan, unless you're marrying one of those PhDs with a gender studies degree. But short of that, you know, it's another rumor, myth that we need to dispel, right? The median monthly payment is $222 a month to repay your student loan, so it's manageable. But, you know, there are just so many myths out there that are, I think, running counter to what we ultimately want to see, which is people following the success sequence, and student loans kind of play into that as well. So thanks for bringing that one up.
Perfect. Okay, well, I think we have reached a quarter till, so we'd love to have some questions. I have one in the front row
here. Dr. Christie, I'm a radiology administrator, so nice to meet you. What about the effect of divorce on the success sequence? Are Americans still getting divorced at a rate of 50%?
I'm sorry, that's a question for you.
Yeah, so, I mentioned just briefly at the beginning today that there was a sort of newer critique of marriage coming from the online right. Andrew Tate, Pearl Davis are the two most kind of prominent proponents of this new critique, and they're saying that marriage is a bad deal for men because most marriages, end in divorce. And a lot of Americans today think that one in two marriages end in divorce, but we've actually seen the divorce rate come down by about 40% since 1980 when it was at its peak rate. And we would estimate probably in the neighborhood of around 40% of marriages end in divorce, kind of for people who are getting married, today or recently. And that's obviously, in my view, kind of still too high, but it's obviously less than one in two. And then my book kind of talks about some ways that couples can minimize risk of divorce, things like regular date nights, things like having a husband who's kind of gainfully employed, things like attending a religious, community, congregation, are all factors that kind of can reduce couples' risk of divorce. So it's still, I think, too common, but the idea that kind of one in two marriages will end in divorce today is no longer the case. Most marriages are going the distance. And one piece of good news to report for family life more generally for our kids is that the share of kids who are being raised in intact married families has been ticking up since around 2012, in part because non-marital childbearing has leveled off since 2009, and in part because the divorce rate continues to go down. So that just means...
Does it have an impact on the success sequence?
So certainly divorce is something that would negatively impact, yes, young adults' financial well-being. So for young adults who are getting married and then getting divorced, they're going to be more vulnerable to poverty, particularly the single, parent that would follow in the wake of that divorce if they have a child. Yes, that's correct. Yep.
Just behind in the front row.
I have a practicality question. How practical is this to implement something like this model? Simply because we're living in a world where, sex is kind of like, you want to go to the movies, you want to have sex, you want to have coffee. I mean, it's there. And marriage really isn't... it's really not that important, unfortunately. And what we're seeing is we're seeing myriads of women in the 30s and 40s who want to have children and they can't find men. And so I just anecdotally, I know so many women who are getting artificially inseminated, or they're adopting, or they're doing whatever. And obviously that's not part of the sequence model, but they simply cannot find men. So what is the practicality of being able to implement something like this?
So I think that's a great question. One of the things that I've heard in response to my new book is, it's really hard for women to find marriageable men. So why are you counseling get married? And I think I've certainly talked to a lot of students at UVA, female students who kind of have articulated this concern and then heard this in other precincts too. So we do, I think, have a real crisis to some extent in sort of how our younger men are basically being formed, both in high school and then in the culture more generally. And they're often not flourishing enough when it comes to education, work, and life more generally, and in ways that kind of affect their marriage ability. So I think we need to be working on that sort of men's issue and that young male issue in our culture to kind of help men become more marriageable. But I also think part of the challenge here is because too many teenage boys and too many young men don't see kind of marriage as part of their, at least immediate future, it reduces their kind of their sort of motivation, if you will, to really apply themselves in school or in technical training or in college or at the workplace in the early 20s. So it's kind of like a vicious cycle. In other words, the less we do to kind of stress sort of the value of marriage, the more a lot of our younger men are not fully engaging when it comes to school, college, technical trade schools, and work. And then that just sort of makes, this marriageability issue more salient. It's also the case, too, that a lot of people who are kind of raising this issue don't really acknowledge or recognize that, again, this problem of male marriageability is especially salient for young men who've grown up without married parents, right? And so I've got a lot of critics on the left who are saying, why are you talking about marriage? There's so many guys out there who are not worthy of marriage. And I'm like, well, why is that the case? Why are there so many young men who are floundering in this culture? Well, it's in part because they haven't had the benefit of a married dad in the household. So I think talking about the sequence, trying to promote it, is one way to kind of get our young adults to, as they do make decisions, make them more prudentially, to encourage our young men to be more intentional about work and marriage, and hopefully become more worthy of marriage as well, and then reduce down the road the number of kids, including the number of boys, who are growing up with the benefit of a father, which only makes the kind of problem that you're talking about, you know, bigger. But I certainly grant the sort of challenge that we face for our young adults, and I think this is sort of one step in the direction of kind of equipping them to realize that if they want to flourish, both as young women and young men, it would be great to get that at least high school degree, to have some experience in the workplace, and then to get married before having any kids.
And I think as, you know, conservatives, I think there's a cheerful optimism of breaking a bad cycle, right? I mean, if part of what's going on with young men is because of, you know, where they came out of, well, we need to help them break the cycle. Delano has his hand up.
Question. So two parts, two very related parts. One, do you have advice for individuals who would like to get the success sequence into schools? I'm thinking, like, could we do this here in DC? And then the second part, which I think is related, is do you think if putting the emphasis of the framing on the success sequence as a three-step anti-poverty plan will help us get in the door better, or get us, make it more likely to get in the door than putting the emphasis on marriage specifically?
So do you want to tackle the getting it into schools? Because you wrote the...
Yeah, I mean, I think the ultimate aim here is for a school board to lay out the specific topics that they would want a classroom at an age-appropriate level to incorporate into the relevant subject, which I would guess would be something around social studies, would be my guess. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, there are probably two or three other topics related to health science that it could be, again, at age-appropriate levels, which is explained in our model here, that it could be incorporated in much the same way that when you look at a set of state standards, you know, they will lay out kindergarten, you're going to go over this, first grade, you're going to go over this, third grade, et cetera. And the success sequence being somewhat shorter than American history, what we lay out and the topics that need to be covered is laid out in our model. So I think you can take it very practically in the same way that you would take a set of standards, right? And say, you know, I would guess in the middle and high school, early high school years, could then be integrated into classrooms. And then.
Branding. I don't know if you have thoughts on
no,
that.
No, I agree. And I think where you're going to go with that. Yeah, I think kind of to answer your question, I think kind of thinking about the sequence in terms of here are three pillars that we know across a whole huge range of evidence are linked to more economic flourishing in America. And so, you know, we can kind of talk about this with our, you know, with our young adults, our kids. That's in terms of avoiding poverty, but also just, you know, flourishing financially and otherwise, you know, emotionally too. So,
mm-hmm. Did you want to finish with that, or are you good on?
No, I was thinking about, you know, we always joke about how you should get fined if you bring up a nation at risk, because every ed policy talks about a nation at risk, right? But 40 plus years later, we're still talking about, and quoting, if an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre education that exists today, we would have called it an act of war, right? I mean, that still gets quoted, whatever, yeah, 40 years later. And so I do think the branding matters a lot, right? If we can get the branding right, get enough eyeballs on it, you know, put it at nation at risk level issue, that we might have some success getting it into schools.
I think there was a question on this side.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ortiz, founder of Capability Consulting, also known as the resident conservative movement disability policy geek. And first of all, I wanted to say thank you for talking about the technical track, because students with disabilities, with intellectual developmental disabilities, are not going to do well in college in most situations, but they can flourish if they have a technical skill. That being said, what did you find, if anything, in your research about how disability impacts these steps? Because it is very significant.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wilson.
That's a great question. I've not looked at that specific issue, but I would certainly think that it certainly is, you know, obviously implicated in all three of the steps, And I also know that the way in which, you know, some of our programs that are helping disabled Americans are kind of not deliberately, but implicitly structured to penalize marriage as well. So that if you marry someone and your income rises just above a certain threshold, you know, you're gonna lose access to benefits that you've been getting, you know, as
unless you have separate checking accounts, which is how my husband and I
right. But so on both on this issue and then just more generally, we know that a lot of Americans whose income are really kind of in that working class bracket are often penalized for getting married when it comes to, you know, many of our programs like Medicaid or some kind of you know, disability program as well. So I think that's certainly one, you know, issue that could be addressed on Capitol Hill as well.
Well, I mean, I know, like you're talking about in schools, I taught school for 10 years, and it was really powerful to be able to be in front of those kids with a disability who didn't think they could do anything.
It's, right.
You know, but how do you get buy-in from the parents when they're when kids are told at home, I don't think you're going to be able to do that,
but yet, how do you get buy-in? Because how, what is your strategy for that? Because you have the parents at home going, oh, I don't know, just be glad with what's put in front of you and the government will take care of you. And then you, but you need to have somebody saying you can do this. And I think we have a real opportunity as the conservatives in the room to say that every person has value and that they can do something. And I'd love to see us have a conversation about that.
Well, I think all of us here kind of appreciate how much for, you know, for most of us, work is a way of deriving a sense of meaning and purpose and identity and most of the time happiness in our lives. And I think insofar as programs are basically, again, not intentionally, but sort of unintentionally kind of discouraging some segment of Americans from working part-time or working full-time, that's a problem. And we need to figure out ways to kind of make the cliff that often emerges when it comes to work for disabled Americans, you know, more like a what's that, the beach thing it's called when you're like in the beach, and like it's a, not a cliff, it's a, but just to kind of, it's, anyways, just to kind of reduce the cliffs that make work more difficult for people who are on some kind of disability.
Well, and I also think that the research, because it shows that if you accomplish two out of the three, or, you know, that also can lead to positive life outcomes. And for individuals who have, you know, special needs or like that, that maybe two out of the three may be more, you know, a better suited. But that's why I think the uniqueness of the various things that we've talked about here in terms of school choice are so important for those individuals. We might have time for one more question. Yes, sir, right back here.
Hi, so the elephant in the room for me in this conversation seems to be that of birth control. And so I was wondering, like, you know, birth control access and birth control education have kind of been kind of a controversial area in, like, the conservative talking space. So I was just kind of wondering how access to birth control and access to birth control education fits into the success sequence model.
Well, I mean, we were just talking earlier, Lindsay, that it's the availability of birth control is pretty widespread.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, and to tie into what you were started us off with, you know, schools aren't even getting math and reading right. Do we really want them to and expect them to be able to get the success sequence right? I think we should expect that of them, but there are so many things that schools are not tackling or are tackling poorly that they need to get right before we even, if we should even be having a conversation within schools, in the school setting at least, about birth control, et cetera. So, you know, I would just say there, if we think about, and we should, schools as almost being safe spaces for children, right? And I think too often we try to push adult issues onto children within a school setting. If we reorient ourselves to what the school really should be, right, get the basics right, if you're in a private school, you know, talk about values-based education, then it doesn't leave as much room for things that are really, I think, off-base or age-inappropriate for a child. I mean, Brad, or I don't know if you have anything else to add, but...
Is planning for a family not, like, relevant enough? You know, like, is that not important enough to be private schools?
I don't know. I mean, if like, you've looked at it in terms of the data.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at that in terms of the data. I mean, I think on the success sequence, the sort of point that probably many of us would take here is just that, you know, this is a deeply pluralistic country, and this is sort of, we're kind of just giving kids a broad sense of, like, these are three things that are really helpful for you in terms of education, work, and marriage, and kind of how particular families are going to, you know, basically translate that message to their kids, or how kids are going to interpret that is going to depend on, you know, their own kind of, you know, value-based commitments. Mm-hmm. So we're not kind of coming in with a, you know, a strong message on sort of how kids are going to navigate the sequence. And we're just kind of saying that what I think, and this has obviously been articulated by Heritage, the sequence, by Brookings, the sequence, by AEI, where I'm affiliated, you know, the sequence. And if you were to talk to scholars at Brookings and at AEI and Heritage about your particular question, you might get some different answers. But I think what we all agree on is just this idea that we can, I think, as Americans, understand and appreciate, again, that there are kind of three pillars for the American dream, and those are education, work, and marriage. And different Americans are going to kind of, or three steps, are going to kind of take that pathway in different ways. But I don't think either of those three steps are really, for most people, and we've actually seen polling data from both Heritage and AEI, there's broad agreement across class lines, single-parent, two-parent lines, racial and ethnic lines, that the sequence kind of makes sense. Now, again, how you kind of do that is probably going to vary from one family to the next.
We are out of time. Thank you for these great questions. Thank you for coming today. Please join me in thanking our panelists.